Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, the 27th of 1998. In the fireside room this morning, we have Joan Beck. Today's session number is 98-4, and it's titled Elijah's Way, 1 Kings 21, Which Executive Privilege? Let's listen in.
It's BC, and gathering from that something about our own lives as people of God's covenant in the 20th, almost 21st century. Please look with me at Psalm 72 to start out with. Give the king your justice, O God, and your righteousness to a king's son. May he judge your people with righteousness and your poor with justice. May the mountains yield prosperity for the people and the hills in righteousness. May he defend the cause of the poor of the people, give deliverance to the needy, and crush the oppressor.
May he live while the sun endures, and as long as the moon throughout all generations. May he be like rain that falls on the mown grass, like showers that water the earth. In his days may righteousness flourish, and peace abound until the moon is no more.
May he have dominion from sea to sea, and from the river to the ends of the earth. May his foes bow down before him, and his enemies lick the dust. May the kings of Tarshish and of the isles render him tribute. May the kings of Sheba and Seba bring gifts. May all kings fall down before him, all nations give him service.
For he delivers the needy when they call, the poor and those who have no helper. He has pity on the weak and the needy, and saves the lives of the needy. From oppression and violence he redeems their life, and precious is their blood in his sight.
This is a psalm in honor of the king. It may have been written and first used with Solomon, and it's just the kind of thing that they could have read and sung or had the official choir sing at every coronation of every king after that. So what is the king's job description that's highlighted right here? What's to characterize the king of God's people?
Take care of the needy and the poor.
You betcha. That is what it should be distinctive about the king of God's people. And all this praise language and, you know, may you beat your enemies and all that sort of stuff that's pretty typical and expected comes back again to, did you notice in verses 12 and 13, needy, the word appears three times in two verses. The care for the needy and the working of righteousness for the people as a whole is the whole point of the king. If this is the standard, today we're going to see how Ahab did, what his report card was like. We have pretty good clue already from looking at Ahab in past chapters. Let's pray. We bless you, God, our maker, ruler of the universe. We thank you for leadership that is in your image, full of shalom, peace, good relationships with you, with one another, and with the earth, and full of compassion for the needy. Help us to be leaders who walk in your ways, even as we learn this morning from the story of Elijah and Ahab. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. There are a couple words that appear and reappear in this psalm, righteousness and justice. In past days, I've talked about the triadic notion of community, of covenantal community that grows out of the experience of the people in the Old Testament and carries on right through the New Testament. Paul Hansen is the one that I attribute for coming up with this triadic notion of community, and I haven't been able to lay my hands on a copy of this book for myself, but it's in the Holden Village Library, autographed by Paul Hansen, who's apparently come up here. So I've been delighted to browse in this a few times. What Paul Hansen says is that the the people of Israel, the people of God, were met by a unique, wonderful God whose name revealed to them as Yahweh, the God who is who he is, and who will be who he will be, but who's characterized particularly by the kind of actions that he does. Namely, he's a deliverer. He's the one who looks out for the oppressed. He's the one who hears the cries of the people in slavery and frees them. And this unique, unrepeatable, singular soul, special God comes to the people, frees them, gives them the gift of a covenant, in other words, the promise of relating with them forever and setting them in relationship with one another in his name and in his way. And that is the unique and special shape of their and dynamic of their community. And so what characterizes that community, besides knowing this God and worshiping this God, is... This is not a good pen. righteousness, neither is that one. Alright. I know there's a good green one here. I had it earlier this morning. It must be this one. Maybe I'm just drawing too fast. This one's better. Alright. Is righteousness, and that's a word from the psalm we just read. The other word in the psalm is justice. But the word that Hansen uses is compassion. And I want to say a little more today about what is righteousness and what is compassion that is also justice. The best way to get at what righteousness is, because that's such an uptight, churchy word, you know, what does it mean really? Kind of sounds like prissy people who just do things a certain way and there's really no room for doing things any other way, a little rigidity and stiffness. But the best story about it is, that I know, is when the Lutheran theologian from the University of Chicago, Joseph Sittler, was living in Jerusalem for a while, and his car broke down. And so he took a car to a neighborhood mechanic who spoke very little English. And after a while, the mechanic had the car running beautifully. The engine was just, the timing was right, it was humming, it was purring, and the mechanic was standing there proudly saying, Tzedakah, Tzedakah, Tzedakah. Well, Sittler was a scholar of the scriptures, and he knew from his Bible study that Tzedakah was the Old Testament word for righteousness. So this engine was humming just right. It was, all its parts were in working order and it was ready to take on the road. It was righteous. So the idea of righteousness is a community that's humming in its well-being. There's a place for everybody. Everybody has good work to do. Everybody has what they need for health and for strength. Everybody lives together with boundaries and with relationships. People are safe. People are able to be there, summarized by the kind of boundaries and instructions we have in the Ten Commandments. If we honor marriages, if we honor our elderly parents, if we don't steal, don't abuse one another's names, if we worship the God who saves us, do not take God's name in vain, remember to practice Sabbath because that's a time of renewal and reminding ourselves that we're not in charge of the world, all of those things that go in the Ten Commandments, it describes a society that can be full of tzedakah, a humming, busy, happy society. When there are people who are suffering, ill, strangers, struck by calamities, without means of support, widows whose men have died in those days with no one to take care of them, children who are orphans and they don't have parents, then this community of God's faithful people needs to practice the other dimension as well, which is compassion. The word compassion in Hebrew is connected with the word for womb. It's a very maternal, nurturing kind of thing. You see somebody and you just go, oh, I have to do something about that. Just the way a mother has to do something about her child who may be in distress. And it's interesting to think of this compassion as being equivalent with justice. It's not mere charity, handing out somebody something to somebody so their suffering is alleviated for a little while. The aim is to help the person come back into the tzedakah, the righteousness of the whole community, so that the whole community is organized to practice shalom, to practice what's not merely the absence of violence, but is the presence of all of those positive things that we need to be related, strong, happy, healthy, productive, faithful people. So,
when there is perfect righteousness, there is no need for justice.
Yeah.
But since there is no perfect righteousness, I can see that triangle being small on one side, larger on the other, as righteousness wins or righteousness loses.
Yeah. And I'm also thinking of just putting the center here, shalom. What this is organized around is healthy, rewarding relationships with God, with one another, and with nature, with God's world. That's what it aims for. And now what Prophet Elijah and the whole prophetic tradition that Elijah represents have been saying to this time, 800 years BC, is that if you forget to relate to this unique, unrepeatable, distinctive God, Yahweh, then it's highly likely that these other two sides of the covenant are also going to collapse. Because if you haven't got Yahweh challenging you, nudging you into righteousness and into compassion, you might very well forget about all that. Other gods come with other value systems. You worship Baal, and you're going to be more interested in other things than righteousness and compassion. You worship somebody else, or you worship nobody. Or if you try to worship a little of everybody, for that matter, some of this other stuff is not going to carry through as clearly and strongly as it needs to.
Or if you worship falsely.
Can we say more about that?
Well, I mean, this may be the later prophets, but the notion that, I hate your holy ordinances and your side.
Right, it's not your sacrifices that accomplish what Yahweh is calling for in the covenant. Which almost is a form of saying, we do worship Yahweh, we do worship Yahweh. And they don't have to do any of the other stuff because they've done the sacrifices. But it's this whole ball of wax as a ball of wax is a dynamic unity. That image doesn't quite work. you get the idea. Okay. Back to 1 Kings 21 then. A majestic narrative, one of the commentators says, that presents these two diametrically opposed notions of community and leadership. We are led to expect that Ahab is going to represent a notion of leadership and community that is not based on this covenant, but is based on something else. And we'll find out as we go along what he thinks he has the right to do as a king. And then the other notion of leadership and of community is this one, this covenantal one that comes from the long history of Israel's tradition and is represented here again by Elijah the prophet. Not only by Elijah, but by Naboth, the owner of the vineyard that Ahab lusts after. Okay, I would appreciate somebody reading verses 1 through 4. And just to set the stage for this, notice the last verse of chapter 20. The king of Israel, that's Ahab, set out towards home, resentful and sullen. That's because of what happened in chapter 20. Things have gone badly for him in battle, and a prophet has confronted him about it. So he's already in a bad mood, going home to Samaria, his palace. Now, verses 1 through 4 of 21.
Well, Naboth, the man from Jezreel, had a vineyard on the outskirts of the city near King Ahab's palace. One day the king talked to him about selling him this land. "I want it for a garden," the king exclaimed, "because it's so convenient to the palace." He offered cash, or if Naboth preferred, a piece of better land and trade. But Naboth replied, "Not on your life. That land has been in my family for generations. So Ahab went back to the palace, angry and sullen. He refused to eat and went to bed with his face to the wall.
This sets up the conflict in a way that is not perfectly clear in the translation that you have there. It's a paraphrase that gives us the situation, but there's some technical language at work that we need to see how the issue turns here. And here's the technical language. Ahab, who has two palaces, one in Samaria and then one up in Jezreel, which is a little farther north. The one in Jezreel is next door to Naboth's vineyard. Ahab says to Naboth, "Give me your vineyard." And he uses the word kerem in Hebrew. This is a translation. This is a totally worthless kerem. Just so, it's not that it's so important, but that's the word he uses. Give me your vineyard. It would make a nice vegetable garden for my palace. And then Naboth says to Ahab, "The Lord forbid that I should give you my ancestral inheritance." He looks at the same plot of ground that Ahab is looking at, and he doesn't see it as a commercially available piece of land. He sees it as a piece of land with which he has a sacred relationship. It's one that God has given to his family since the time they've come to the promised land, and it is not up to him to sell it. He doesn't even own it as far as he's concerned. It's God's land that he is permitted to use. And Naboth uses the word Nahala. This little dot over here, did you say kind of Nahala? Nahala. And so he's saying it's a sacred piece of land. Keeping your thumb in 1 Kings 21, let's go back to Leviticus 25. There's some land use law here in chapter 25, which explains what's going on. And the basic idea is this. God has given the land, Leviticus 25. God has given the land to the people of Israel as follows. I'm going to read verses 18 to 28. "You shall observe my statutes and faithfully keep my ordinances." Why? "So that you may live on the land securely." This is not an arbitrary thing, but God's aim is the well-being of the people, living on the land securely. "The land will yield its fruit, and you will eat your fill and live on it securely." Now, the next couple of verses are about the fact that God is commanding that they give the land a Sabbath every seventh year, just as they give themselves a Sabbath every seventh day. The land is to lie fallow. They're not to work it every seventh year. And people might be concerned, well, how are we going to live in that year that we're not farming? And God is reassuring them, "Should you ask, 'What shall we eat in the seventh year if I may not sow or gather in our crop?' I will order my blessing for you in the sixth year so that it will yield a crop for 3 years. For that year, for the year of Sabbath, and then for the year that you are working the land, but the crop hasn't come in yet. When you sow in the eighth year, you'll be eating from the old crop. Until the ninth year, when the produce comes in, you shall eat the old." And then, now, here is this idea of Nahala. The land shall not be sold in perpetuity. It shall not ever be sold. For it is mine. The land is mine. With me you are but aliens and tenants. Throughout the land that you hold, you shall provide for the redemption of the land. This is what happens if for some reason economic hardship comes and you do have to sell the land to get some money for the time being. If any one of your kin falls into difficulty and sells a piece of property, then the next of kin shall come and redeem what the relative has sold. Your brother-in-law might come and buy it back for you so you can keep having a place to live and work and eat off of. If the person has no one to redeem it but then prospers and finds sufficient means to do so, The year since its sale shall be computed, and the difference shall be refunded to the person to whom it was sold, and the property shall be returned. There's this ongoing concern that the land will come back to the people who need it to live off of it. There's also an interesting idea about the value of land here. A little earlier it says, if you have to sell your land, you're not really selling the land. What you're selling is the rights to the harvest for a few years. And there was also the idea that we'll come to, let's keep reading. If there's not sufficient means to recover it, what was sold shall remain with the purchaser until the year of Jubilee. In the Jubilee, it shall be released and the property shall be returned. The Jubilee was an idea that every 50 years, all of the damage that had been done by economic upheaval during the 50 years would be undone. Things would go back to square one and every family would get its land back, even if they'd had to sell it because of debts or calamities. So you got a fresh start. And the property of land was adjudicated in connection with how soon or far it was after the Jubilee or before the Jubilee. So if it's just been the Jubilee and my family has its land back and in 10 years we get in trouble and we have to sell our land, we can sell it for a high price because whoever we sell it to is going to get to use it for 40 years unless we buy it back. But if it's only 10 years until the Jubilee happens again, then the value of the land is quite low because they'll only get 10 years of profits, of harvest anymore. And that means I might even be able to buy it back because my land hasn't increased in value. It's actually decreased because it only has 10 more harvests until the Jubilee and I get it back anyhow. So this whole system is skewed to protecting the rights of people whose only means of making a living is their land. And the people obviously took this as a sacred trust, and it's that point of view that Naboth is speaking for. And it's that point of view that Ahab doesn't get. He's got money, he sees the land, he thinks he should be able to buy it. He doesn't ask how it would devastate Naboth's family and how Naboth would make a living. He thinks, in fact, that offering him a good price for it or even giving him another vineyard is going to take care of the problem. But Ahab is so out of touch with the covenant. And Naboth isn't. So any comments or questions on this?
Do they have taxes then on your land?
The king did tax people. In 1 Samuel 8, Samuel the prophet warned people, if you have a king, you're going to have to be taxed to support the king. So there were royal taxes. And there probably were also like taxes of use in the sense of if you want to use a road and it goes through, you have to pay a toll or something.
Well, did the person operating, whether he owned it or just was borrowing it until the next Jubilee, was he responsible for the taxes of the original owner?
Oh, interesting question. I don't know about that. And I think we know more about the truth of that in Jesus' time than we do in the Old Testament.
Did the Jubilee ever...
No, historic. Sad to say, probably as far as we know, the Jubilee never did happen. But it's a splendid idea, don't you think?
5 years.
Every 5 years would be even better than every 50. You betcha. Alrighty, let's please read 5 through 16 in chapter 21 of 1 Kings. Back to our main story.
But Jezebel, his wife, came to him and said to him, why is your spirit so vexed that you eat no food? And he said to her, because I spoke to Naboth and Jezreelite and said to him, give me your vineyard for money or else, if it please you, I will give you another vineyard for it. And he answered, I will not give you my vineyard.
Just please note Ahab's vast misunderstanding of Naboth's position, because when he retells the story, he just uses this property word, this commercial word, vineyard, and he doesn't get that Naboth had refused him on the grounds of it being his nahalah, his sacred inheritance that he kept in trust for his whole family's and descendants' well-being. Keep going.
And Jezebel, his wife, said to him, do you now govern Israel? Arise and eat bread, and let your heart be cheerful. I will give you the vineyard of Naboth and Jezreelite.
Could I keep interrupting you, Steve? You're gonna give me a hard time if I do that.
No.
Jezebel's question, do you now govern Israel? Is she saying something like, are you the king or not? No. What's a king supposed to be able to do? You know, duh.
She's really kind of saying to him, I don't quite get why you don't understand what your power is. She says, get up, eat some food. It's real interesting. That's just what the angel said to Elijah when he was on his way to Mount Horeb. But that was a message of strength, and was a food of strength. And this Jezebel is really arrogating power to herself here. I will give you the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite, as if she could. And she really is setting herself up against God, because this would be breaking God's law to do it. Keep going. We'll see how she carries it out.
So she wrote letters in Ahab's name and sealed them with his seal. And she sent the letters to the elders and the nobles who dwelt in Naboth in his city. And she wrote the letters, proclaim a fast and set Naboth on high among the people, and set two base fellows opposite him, and let them bring a charge against him, saying, you have cursed God and the king, then take him out and stone him to death. And the men of his city, the elders and the nobles who dwelt in his city, did as Jezebel had sent word to them.
Notice it's a plot, and the view of the narrator here is that all those rich folks, rich and powerful folks, stick together. And what chance has the common man, even though he's a leader among his fellows? Go ahead.
As it was written in the letters which she had sent to them, they proclaimed a fast and set Naboth on high among the people. And the two base fellows came.
Well, my translation says scoundrels. Have you got any other words for these guys? There's a definite point of view in the way this story is told. These two worthless idiots. These two bad guys. Okay.
And the two base fellows came in and sat opposite him. And the base fellows brought a charge against Naboth in the presence of the people, saying, Naboth cursed God and the king. So they took him outside the city and stoned him to death with stones. Then they sent to Jezebel, saying, Naboth has been stoned. He is dead.
And you can go to 16.
As soon as Jezebel heard that Naboth had been stoned and was dead, Jezebel said to Ahab, arise, take possession of the vineyard of Naboth and Jezreelite, which he refused to give you for money. For Naboth is not alive, but dead. And as soon as Ahab heard the news that Naboth was dead, Ahab arose to go down to the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite to take possession of it.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is obviously a kangaroo court, and it's obviously a surprise to Naboth he wasn't in on the letter that Jezebel sent, or presumably he wouldn't have shown up. You would call a fast if you wanted to have a religious ceremony. It was part of special religious ceremonies. You'd call a fast if there was a serious decision to be made. Who knows exactly how they could get away with calling a fast or how they justified it. But when it happened, Jezebel knows Israelite law very well. She knows that it's going to take two witnesses to convict somebody. And she also knows the law that says if a person dies and they have no heirs, their property reverts to the crown. So all they have to do is get Naboth out of the way, and then without making an effort, Ahab gets what he wants, the vineyard. In 2 Kings chapter 9, where Ahab's second son is finally killed, the quote there says, refers back to Naboth, and it says Naboth and his children had been killed. Because in fact, if he'd had any children, they would have gotten the land even though their father had been stoned. So it's not, from this story, it only sounds like there's Naboth. From 2 Kings 9, it sounds like maybe the kids had been killed too. But either way, it's outrageous. Now, it's all set up in a very plausible sort of way. We know that Naboth had refused the land to Ahab, and quite possibly he had done it in the name of the Lord. And so they're not just making up things that sound totally ridiculous. They're coming, and these bad guys, these scoundrels, are coming and saying something like, he refused the king's legitimate offer and thereby betrayed the king.
And he did it by taking God's name in vain, when everyone knows that you're supposed to go along with what the king wants, or something like that. So Naboth isn't even given a voice here. What he could say in his own defense, or the people rising up against him, I mean, it's just pictured as an absolute railroad situation or a bulldozer kind of thing. You know, the king wants it, the king gets it. All the royal people and nobles in town are in on it, and poor Naboth doesn't have a chance. And he's been stoned. Now, there's also an element of protectiveness on Jezebel's part here. She is the agent doing this. She's doing it in Ahab's name. And as far as the prophetic tradition is concerned, Ahab is where the buck stops. He's the one who's responsible. But probably, as far as Jezebel is concerned, she's protected Ahab from getting his hands bloodied, and he's not guilty of this. And she very delicately tells him, he's dead, you can have it now. She doesn't say, you know, I caused him to be killed, and all that other stuff that would implicate Ahab as part of the crime. And so, the word take possession is a word that Bible reading people have heard before. When Ahab goes to take possession of Naboth's vineyard, he's doing the same thing that God's people did when they entered the promised land, to take possession of it. In other words, Ahab is being called a triumphalist, a territorial usurper at this point. Now, it was justified when the people of Israel went into the land because God had promised it to them. It is not justified when Ahab does it, because he had no promise of God that he should take possession of this. In fact, the land belonged to someone else. But here he is acting like an imperialist, acting like...
Isn't there a parable of Jesus that had the people taking over the vineyard?
Yeah. You remember that parable? The landlord was gone out of the country, and the servants took it over and ran it their own way and refused to give the proceeds to the owner. Jesus used the vineyard parable more than once. And that's another nice level to look at in connection with this story. It's about Naboth and Ahab and Naboth's vineyard and Ahab's greed. But there's also a level at which the vineyard is understood to be all of Israel, and Israel is God's vineyard. And 2 Samuel something or other actually says that Israel is God's inheritance. It's the whole country, all the people are God's sacred property that he is not to sell, that he is not to squander, that he is to tend, has committed himself to tend carefully.
Does it use the word Nahalah for the people?
I haven't had a chance to, and it will take me a long time to do that, but my suspicion is that it's a related word, as far as I can tell from English. Going into that. And I hope we'll have a chance to talk about Israel as the vineyard. Let's just stick with this situation for a little bit longer, though. This first part now has mostly been narrative, and it's artfully told the story in such a way that we are hissing at Ahab, and we are sad, and we think it's tragic that Naboth has been cheated out and denied his rights according to the covenant. And the second part of this chapter is going to just make this perfectly clear in the prophet's words, God's words, and the narrator's words. And the hot condemnation just gets heaped on pretty high. Let's read 17 to 24.
Then the word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite, saying, go down to meet King Ahab of Israel, who rules in Samaria. He is now in the vineyard of Naboth, where he has gone to take possession. You shall say to him, thus says the Lord, have you killed and also taken possession? You shall say to him, thus said the Lord, in the place where the dogs licked up the blood of Naboth, dogs will also lick up your blood. Ahab said to Elijah, have you found me, O my enemy? He answered, I have found you, because you have sold yourself to do what is evil in the sight of the Lord. I will bring disaster on you. I will consume you and will cut off from Ahab every male, bond or free, in Israel. And I will make your house like the house of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, and like the house of Baasha, son of Ahijah.
Just let me insert a note. What were their houses like? They were Ahab's predecessors who were dead and gone, and their sons and grandsons did not rule on the throne. Their dynasties had been cut off. I mean, they had no power anymore. Ahab's going to be like that. He's not going to have any successors either, is what the promise or the threat is here.
Because you have provoked me to anger and have caused Israel to sin. Also concerning Jezebel, the Lord said, the dogs shall eat Jezebel within the bounds of Jezreel. Anyone belonging to Ahab who dies in the city, the dogs shall eat. And anyone of his who dies in the open country, the birds of the air shall eat.
Just let me insert another thing here. I mean, it was really terrible if you couldn't be buried. It was really important for people to honor their dead by taking their bodies and burying them. And this says you're going to be so far rejected and out there that there's not even going to be anybody who's going to come after your body. And you're going to be left to the dogs, or the birds if you're out in the country, the dogs in the city. Terrible fate. Just humiliated after death as well as before death.
It's also a stunning example of the notion of corporate responsibility versus individual responsibility. We know that there were three or four players that set this up, but it says that you caused Israel to sin.
Yeah. All right, here's a summary then of Ahab's reign in 25 and 26.
Indeed, there was no one like Ahab, who sold himself to do what was evil in the sight of the Lord, urged on by his wife Jezebel. He acted most abominably in going after idols, as the Amorites had done when the Lord drove out before the Israelites.
It's again a comparison with some time ago. The Amorites had been in the land when the people came into the promised land. God promised the promised land to them, and it was okay for them to drive out the Amorites who had worshipped idols. But here is the betrayer right within the house of Israel. The king himself has forsaken what the country stands for and the God that they worship. And it's just unspeakable awfulness. And he is going to be rejected as if he were this godless foreigner, for in fact he has shown himself to be a godless foreigner and not worthy of being at the head of state in Israel.
Can I ask a question about a couple of words?
Yeah.
You used the term take possession and refer back to what the children of Israel were to do when they reached the promised land. And my recollection is not only were they to take over the real estate, but they were to totally obliterate everybody that lived there. I mean, essentially clean house and set up a whole new society. So is take possession more than just sort of...
It's a militant word. It's a word of conquest. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the betrayal here, I mean, you know, there's a whole other question of whether that is an appropriate stance that we still wish to take towards people who are not of our tribe. We won't be talking about that right now. But the fact here that Ahab has taken this stance of conquest against someone for whom he is responsible, one of the needy in his own land, is what's the terrible betrayal right here and the awful thing that he's done.
And also the term that is in verse 25, Ahab, like Ahab, who sold himself to do what was evil.
Yeah. I think it's clearly saying Ahab was interested in money. He was a capitalist. He cared more for the dollars than he cared for the covenant.
It strikes me, now I don't know what the Hebrew is here, but it's language we use for prostitution too. And that there is this deep Old Testament strain of worshiping idols as a form of prostitution, that the giving of your very self over to one who is not God. I mean, so I wonder if there's even that undercurrent of to take an idol as your god, as your chief lover, since there's all that
yes.
fidelity language and infidelity language about faith. If in a sense he prostituted himself,
yeah.
he sold himself to the idol of money.
Well, let's just absolutely. I think that's there, and I want us to go back to the what we know about righteousness using the Ten Commandments and see what kind of charges could lawfully be brought against Ahab just out of this chapter for doing what he did. Let's consider the first commandment. Has he taken, Ahab is guilty of, has he had another god before him besides, yes. Has he taken the name of the Lord his God in vain?
Yes.
Has he broken the Sabbath? Somebody in the other hour thought, maybe in the sense of his disregarding the laws of Jubilee,
yeah, I think, yeah,
was connected with breaking Sabbath or disregarding Sabbath. How about dishonoring his parents?
Mm-hmm, certainly.
Certainly?
I would think so.
He followed in their footsteps.
He followed in their footsteps, and they were already abandoning the Lord. This is probably not a charge that's brought against him, but in the sense of keeping family honor, I suppose you could say that he did. So we'll say maybe he did. How about killing? Is he guilty of killing? Absolutely. Is he guilty of committing adultery? In the spiritual sense. has he stolen?
Yes.
Has he borne false witness?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Stealing to be grammatically correct. Okay. And has he coveted?
Oh, yeah.
All right. So, I mean, blatant example of an abuse of power. And one thing about the covenant is that it was quite even-handed. The only true king that Israel had was Yahweh. And even the king was not really the king. He was to be the servant of the people and the servant of God, and he was to have no special privileges that all the people didn't have. And likewise, all the people had the same responsibilities that the king had. And so a very egalitarian kind of covenant. And Ahab has just trashed the whole thing here. And Elijah has called him on it. Well, now, here's a switch. We haven't seen this before. Verses 27 to 29.
Heard these words, he tore his clothes from on sackcloth and fasted. He lay in sackcloth and went around meekly. Then the word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite, have you noticed how Ahab has humbled himself before me? Because he has humbled himself, I will not bring this disaster on in this day, but I will bring it on his house in the days of his son.
So there is a little bit of repentance on Ahab's part when he's confronted by the prophet, and there's some mitigating of the disaster, or at least delaying of the disaster by God in response. Now, this whole story of Naboth's vineyard echoes in my mind as being like the story of David, the great king, when he sinned against the covenant by abusing his power to get the wife of Uriah, one of his generals. He saw Bathsheba, he lusted after her, he slept with her, she became pregnant. He had Uriah killed so that he could bring Bathsheba into his own house. He thought he could get away with it, but the Lord sent Nathan, the prophet, to David
And Nathan the prophet indirectly, not as directly as Elijah confronts Ahab, but indirectly tells David a story about a rich man who had a whole huge flock of goats and sheep, and his next door neighbor, who was a poor man who had one little lamb that he kept in his own house and baby slept in his own bed and held in his own arms and fed from his own food. And when the rich man had company, he didn't want to kill any one of his many sheep or goats, but he took the lamb of his neighbor and slaughtered that one for the guests to eat. David becomes incensed and says, that man ought to be punished. He has clearly broken faith with his neighbor and with the God of the covenant. And Nathan the prophet says to the king, David, you are the man. David gets it, and he responds by fasting, by mourning, by repenting, just as Ahab did here. What's the difference between David and Ahab? The way the stories are told, I think the big difference is that by and large, David set the standard or lived into the model of being the king who was the servant of God and the servant of the people, with some occasional grievous lapses. And the Ahab story is the other way. This is a king who, by and large, forsook Yahweh and the covenant and did it with a certain arrogance and I don't care attitude, devil may care attitude, with an occasional lapse in the direction of repentance. Yeah.
There's also an interesting parallel about the children. The child of Bathsheba dies. Children of Ahab are cursed.
Yes, and they're going to die in the next couple of chapters.
What do you think about that theologically?
Ooh. Let's have that be one of the things that we're willing to talk about here. And the other question that I bring to you now is, looking at the world around us, who are the Naboths? And who are the Ahabs and the Jezebels? The ones with power who think they can throw their power around to take advantage of the poor. The message of this chapter is that God is on the side of the oppressed, and God will punish those in power who use their power to take things away from the poor. But we'll use looking our own eyes to look at our own world and try to say, who are the Naboths? Who are the ones in power that are taking advantage of the Naboths? And also, remember, Jezebel did this all under a pretense of piety. And so how is the church complicit in the Ahabs and Jezebels taking advantage of the Naboths in our world?
Do you want an open answer, or do you want us just to think about it?
Well, I think we can toss it around for a while, or we can say how we see it from our point of view.
Is it kind of like, let's say, the county wants to take a piece of land and build it, so they just condemn a person's land that maybe somebody that's 75 years old and they've got a little garden and this is where they've lived all their life and they don't want to move.
Mm-hmm.
And so the government comes in and they say, look, we're going to do this because we want to do this and it's for the good of the community.
Mm-hmm.
Or like our country taking advantage of third world countries and using them for labor for our greed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's wearing clothes sewn by people who are working in sweatshops.
Yeah.
It's, are there more, can we use this chapter in some way, this story in some way to pry open the way we look at our own world more prophetically, with more concern for justice?
Palestine might be a good place. For 2,000 years, these folks who lived there have not been the Hebrew people. I mean, in terms of, I mean, it mixed, of course. That they've really taken off their land many times. They were just removed.
Palestinians, you mean?
Palestinians.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Are taken off.
their land and not given what they need for their sustenance.
Would the slave labor fall into that category?
Mm-hmm. Say more of what you're thinking. Slaves would be people who are being taken advantage of by people who have more economic power or are able to use them to support their own.
Well, I read where some places they have people chained, or they're even sold to other people that would take the same advantage.
The Jews in Europe in the 30s and 40s, where their land was taken, and we're reading about the Swiss's complicity with that, and how the Swiss are now paying $50 billion or something like that, whatever, $4 billion, mm-hmm. or two, because their land was unfairly taken from them.
Mm-hmm. You bet.
But the Swiss participated.
So this is a plot that happens over and over and over again. And if you use this plot kind of like a magnifying glass and look at this time in history a little more closely, or that time in history, or at our own situation, you'll see things you might not otherwise notice without the help of this story and its prophetic opening up of the way that power can be used and abused.
On a personal level, too, you can think of people that married people for money. As you were talking about prostitution, using the money as the idol.
Yeah. The whole point of the covenant is for shalom relationships, healthy, healthful, whole relationships with one another. And the whole sex industry, as people who work against prostitution call it, cheapens people and denies their worth, kind of on both sides of it, the ones who pay and the ones who are bought that way. So it is definitely a breaking of a covenant and taking away something sacred to the person, her integrity of her own body. Our theme book for this summer is Practicing Our Faith, edited by Dorothy Bass. It contains 11 or 12 chapters about different ways the church has tried to live out its faith in response to the God who has loved us, saved us, made us, and challenges us to live in God's image. One of the chapters by Sharon Parks is on household economics. And it updates some of the themes from this chapter into terms that we're currently experiencing. Sharon Parks says, we live in a world where economics is worldwide. The word economics comes from the Greek word oikos, which means house. And in our own homes, we learn how to get along with people long term, how to express our rage, how to practice forgiveness. But we dare not forget that our home is not just our household, but is also the whole planet. And that economics is ecological as well as having to do with money. So economics has to do with our relationships with one another at home. It has to do with our relationships with one another over the whole planet and our relationships with the planet and its resources. How have Christians tried to practice household economics locally, globally, in ways that reflect that God is our creator and our savior and the Spirit who lives with us? She comes up with some suggestions, reporting particularly from the Quakers and from the Mennonites. One of the themes is Christians have tried to live simply, tried to say, we don't need everything. What is the little that we need in order to live a good life? There's the theme of mutual aid. We need to help one another. There's the theme of right labor. Are the people who are producing the goods and services we use being adequately compensated for it, or are they suffering because we are taking advantage of their labor? There's the question of right technology. Just because we can build it, should we? Just because we can have it, should we? And so she brings up questions like that, all of which are to remind us that for us the question is how to make the material things that we have and participate in reflect the incarnation of God in our world. We don't want to say, spiritual is good, material is bad. What we want to say is the material world that we live in and that we have money in, that we buy and sell things in, that we occupy, the land that we use, are places where God can become incarnate. And that's our aim as Christians. Now, if Ahab had thought his aim was to use his power and his land to make God incarnate, that's using Christian language that Ahab wouldn't have been capable of, but to make real the God of the covenant and the relationships that that God established, he would have been a different kind of king. So, now is a chance for you to respond to the way Sharon Parks puts it or anything else that comes out of the story as you think about your own economic practices and the practices of our country and of global corporations and everything else. It's kind of a wide open question. Take it anywhere you want.
Sure. So.
Am I getting off the point if I say something that we're working on right now in our church is some air conditioning? Is that superfluous? This summer has been an extremely hot summer, and because generally we don't need it on Sunday morning, if you open doors you can get through. Our late service is 9:30. If we were at 11, no one would come. This summer has been tremendous, and we've had people almost pass out and so forth, and we have a vacation Bible school of 870 kids and 300 and some workers, and they couldn't handle some of the rooms on the upper level. And I had a wedding almost every weekend. If I didn't, the other coordinator did, so we had weddings that were almost impossible to hold. Now I'm working on air conditioning. Is that superfluous? Because I'm concerned about that, as to whether we're asking for just modern conveniences or whether we have air conditioning in the new part of the building that was just finished last year and in the offices, but we don't have it in the older Sunday school rooms, and we don't have it in the sanctuary.
That is a really helpful way to ask the question. How is the question of air conditioning connected with our responsibility to be stewards of the gifts that God has given and to care for the neighbor? And I don't suppose it's not perfectly clear how the decision will come out, but your process of discerning it, it's really important to bring in that aspect of it. So that's...
Well, what is happening is even for the 8 o'clock service, I heard people say about two Sundays ago, I'm not coming back until fall if we don't get some air conditioning. So they said something to Pastor, and Pastor and I have already been working on this, and I called probably a dozen people to get support, not backing, but because before we go to the board, we want to make sure that we have a consensus. Yeah. And what he said to that person was, please write a letter. In other words, you know, we need your support. I hadn't talked to that person this year. I did a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And so we are wondering now.
Good case in point.
It's hard to ignore the change in philosophy. I mean, the hold in mind was worked in an atmosphere where, you know, we're here for economic gain, damn the consequences. You know, we've got cubic miles of tailings out here that are poisoning the creek, some fear for the lake. This is a very isolated little pocket of that, but a few years ago we drove around the Olympic Peninsula, and for miles you'd see forest, or what was left of forest that had been cut, but nothing but trash left lying around. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is not good stewardship.
Mm-hmm.
Cut it and move on, or plow it and move on, or we're worried about now the rainforest, you know, cut it down, burn it up, and plant for a couple of years. And people are becoming so numerous, we're going to be in difficulty if we keep up with that sort of thing. That is not stewardship.
We have treated the land as a vineyard rather than as a sacred inheritance.
Well,
hardly
as a mine, really.
Yeah.
You know, we use up what we've got here and go on to someplace else.
Yeah.
And,
Let's let this conversation continue at coffee hour, and if you want to head right out to the coffee or somewhere else right now, you're free to go. The bell has rung, but we've always tried to pick a hymn of the day and